talking with New Hampshire author Thomas Lee. His brand new book, Battle Babel, Selling War in America, has just been released.
In the years literally leading up to the current war in Iraq, being retired, I thought I really ought to watch a little more television. That was one of the things retired people should do. So I began to watch cable TV, and it became very obvious that this particular war, not unlike other wars, was being sold before it happened as entertainment, particularly in the cable channels, MSNBC, Fox, obviously, even CNN. They were vying for each other for graphics, talking heads, retired generals, and so on. So there was an air of unreality about the war. War was entertainment. The language that was used by these mainstream media was the same language being used by government spokespersons. This was language to really two categories: language that softens the harsh realities of war, killing, mutilation, torture, destruction of people's lives, and language which encouraged participation and support for the war under the guise of patriotism. It was so obvious to me after only a short time of following this that by the time the war began, I began thinking of writing something which zeroed in on this particular aspect of war propaganda, that is the language used to encourage participation and to essentially soften reality.
Can you give some examples of some of the terms that you that you describe in Battle Babel?
Sure. The book really has three categories, although they're not designated as such. I've really set this up as a dictionary. It's in alphabetical form. There are over 200 terms that I included. There are really three categories. One is familiar euphemisms, things that we're used to hearing: collateral damage, friendly fire, detainees, and the whole set of typical euphemisms for killing: neutralize, dispatch, take out, mopping up, cleaning up. And those are euphemisms that we're used to, although they've become part of the background of war. I also included a category of terms which aren't ordinarily thought of as euphemisms, terms that sound rather comforting: Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, National Security Strategy, Committee for the Protection and Security of the Gulf, this sort of thing. And I've also included what I found was important is a whole series of words which we've come to accept and be comfortable with surrounding war. Words like glory, bravery, terms like win the peace, God bless our country, God bless our troops, support the troops, patriotism. If you analyze these, all of these are part of the language surrounding war to engender support and to cover the reality of war. So these are the categories. I'll give you a few examples. Let me add first that I began to write this book in what I thought would be a series of 400 or 500 brief definitions of war euphemisms. It turned out that as I started writing the definitions, they turned into short essays because one can't really give a snap definition. I didn't want the book to be simply satire. There's a whole category of books out there, Bush bashing books, many of which I've read and I've enjoyed. But I wanted this to be a book which was, first of all, honest, give facts, give the truth. And I want it to be ironic. Irony in its strict sense means using one's own words to prove the issue. And what I've done is quote people and use the terms that are actually used in the media and by the government and let them speak for themselves in many cases. Let me just give you a couple of sample parts of definitions. Most of these run a page or so or more. My definition of win the peace: after attacking the enemy, devastating their land, and killing and injuring sufficient numbers of them to cause them to surrender, convince them that all the terrible destruction, death, and suffering was for their ultimate benefit. If any object to this largesse and become aggressive, they are to be terrified into submission or, if necessary, killed. Eventually, all survivors are expected to be content with their lot. If you look at patriotism, I begin this way. Patriotism, generally understood as a devoted loyalty to and support for one's country. This notion is particularly dangerous when one identifies one's country as the prevailing government. In that case, the ideal patriot abets in and obeys the orders of the state, including its injunctions to wage war. Those who rebel against the decisions of the state are considered unpatriotic. Perhaps I could read page 193, the injunction which our president has often used, God bless. An invocation popular in the United States, especially among its elected leaders, asking the divinity, generally regarded as Christian, to look favorably on the United States and its troops as they fight the enemy, who are not to be considered worthy of God's protection. And if I may add one more, because this was the first definition I wrote, when I was first trying to decide how I would actually write this book, I woke up one morning about 4 o'clock, and this definition appeared to me, as it does when you're writing things. Writing is really dictation. It somehow appears after a lot of thought. But let me just read quickly my complete definition of flag. Flag, a piece of cloth variously colored, often displayed in order to stimulate feelings of patriotism among citizens. The American flag bears 13 stripes of white and red, representing the 13 colonies established on land taken by force from the original inhabitants. The flag represents honor, hope, and pride, often justifiably. Those citizens who display the flag, on their vehicles or elsewhere, are regarded by many to be the more loyal to their country. Military personnel are taught to have a particular devotion to the flag. When they are killed in the line of duty, their coffins are draped with the flag. It is removed before interment because burying a flag is considered to be disrespectful.
It seems to me, especially when we're talking about I realize some of these terms go back, you know, way, way far back. But with some of the ones that are currently in use, particularly for application to so-called Iraqi freedom, these are not terms that George W. Bush comes up with. It seems to me he's too linguistically challenged to be the one coming up with these things. Where do these things come from? Have you gotten a sense of that in your research?
Many of the terms that appear in this book are terms that have been around for many, many years. Honor, bravery, and so on. There's a whole new set, particularly when it has to do, as you mentioned, Operation Iraqi Freedom. The practice of naming military functions as operations goes back to before the Second World War. In fact, Winston Churchill was quite instrumental in developing this system. Churchill, I must add, I'm getting off track here, but it's to the point. We ought to remember, and there's a lot of history in this book, a lot of facts and history about all of this. We should remember that the British occupied Iraq back in around 1920, and essentially occupied that country for over the next 30 years under various guises. Churchill, in the early years of the British occupation of Iraq, ordered carpet bombing. In fact, was one of the co-inventors of the carpet bombing tactic. That is, you bomb everything, everything in sight. In fact, Churchill wanted to use poison gas to suppress these nasty Iraqis who were making trouble. But they wouldn't allow him to do that, but he certainly did lay waste to the country. So this is, to Iraq, this is not new. The British have come back. But at any rate, under operation, a quote from Winston Churchill. Churchill, early to understand the public relation value of labels, warned against names for military functions that disparage in any way or enable some widow or mother to say that her son was killed in an operation called Bunny Hug or Ballyhoo. So by the war's end, the War Department, which is now the Department of Defense, began creating names for all sorts of things. Operation Crossroads was one of the first for the atomic bomb tests and Bikini. And, of course, this went right up into Vietnam, Operation Masher, Operation Killer. But we've now, the Department of Defense now says that operations must be selected carefully so as not to be, quote, counterproductive, or, quote, to express a degree of bellicosity inconsistent with traditional American ideals or current foreign policy. You might remember that the invasion of Afghanistan. In this book, I emphasize the Gulf War, the first Gulf, first war against Iraq, and the second war, Operation Iraqi Freedom, as it's called, and also Operation Enduring Freedom, which was our assault against Afghanistan. You might remember that the original name was Operation Infinite Justice, but there was an outcry of that against that because obviously that is. It became obvious it was offensive to the Islamic world, which, of course, by the way, our entire operations against Iraq are, and this is what's created terrorism. There were no terrorists in Iraq before our latest attack, and there certainly are now. We've spawned this.
It seems to me that language has become more of something that's inspired or even directly drawn from marketing-type firms and PR firms and things like that. I mean, groups like Hill & Knowlton and the Rendon Group have been used extensively for the last 10 or 15 years by our government to pitch things. And then, of course, you have Condoleezza Rice a couple of years ago when talking about the impending invasion of Iraq, saying something to the effect that it didn't happen in August because you never roll out a new product in August or something to that effect. I mean, do you have a sense that a lot of these terms are sort of pitched by that type of firm?
You're absolutely right on the use of public relations firms to push the war. I think that George Bush, as I think many people acknowledge, does not generate a lot of his own ideas. He has a lot of people surrounding him. And certainly Hill & Knowlton and the Rendon Group were given literally millions of dollars in the lead-up to the war. And I have a number of references to this in the book. Public relations campaigns to essentially sell the war. The war was sold under false pretenses. The war, of course, was sold as a means of preventing Iraq from attacking us with weapons of mass destruction. When that did not prove to be the case, which certainly the Pentagon knew beforehand, it somehow morphed into an effort to liberate Iraq and somehow democratize. These terms are all in democratization. I must add here that my position, I didn't simply write this book out of an exercise, or I'm not an English professor, an exercise in rhetoric. My basic position is that this war should never have been fought, and further, no wars should ever be fought. My position is that of a pacifist. I think we should be using at least as much energy and funding towards developing nonviolent solutions to international conflicts as we do for the military. And that's a tall order. As soon as you say pacifist, that's kind of an inflammatory term. It's a tall order, but I want my book to be a part of that effort to move towards, and I mentioned this in my preface, to move towards nonviolent means of resolving conflict. And the way I decided to do that, to play my part in that, is to expose the language surrounding war and the language supporting war as what I hope will be a means to move people, the general public, towards an understanding of the realities of war and the need to to develop nonviolent means. That's what's really was behind my my writing this. When people write what are called liberal or progressive books, they often end up preaching to the choir. And I know a lot of the choir, and I love them, and I hope they read the book. But I also want the book to get into the mainstream. Fortunately, the book has been recommended by several people who are very much involved in peace education across the country, high school and college courses and programs. And I'm hoping that it will be used as a reference source for students studying peace and justice. It's filled with website references and other references that they can use as a good source to go on and follow up on a lot of these ideas. I'd like to add as well that this book is not an anti-soldier book. This is an anti-war book. I make it very clear that the young men who are asked to join the military and who are offered the propaganda of money, learning a profession, adventure, travel, I don't blame these young men. Once they're in, once they're taught to kill whoever the government tells them is the enemy, then they're not given a chance to express any moral scruples. If they do, this is considered out of line, and they face jail. So many young men, I certainly know from a lot of reading and study and talking to people on this, so many of the young men and women in Iraq don't want to be there, don't think they should be there, but they're impressed with their commitment to their requirements. And of course, there's always the overlay of the sense of patriotism and so on, which is confused, and which I can talk about in this book. So what I want to make very clear is that I'm not criticizing soldiers or individuals. I think we're all subject to this wave of rhetoric, which is very harmful, and I don't blame them at all.
And when we were talking about the current Bush administration and their use of PR firms and so on that influence the language that ultimately is used to push a violent agenda or a warlike agenda, I think it's worth pointing out that this is not something that's exclusive to the Republican Party or any other party. It seems to me that I recall something about humanitarian bombings back during the Clinton administration.
Yeah, one of the definitions of my book is humanitarian intervention. Humanitarian intervention means going into a country and bombing the hell out of it for their own good. I might add that after the Gulf War, 1991, Iraq was subjected to 12 years of sanctions, which included not only the starvation of probably a million Iraqis, but constant bombing, including bombing ordered by the Clinton administration. So this country was devastated for many, many years before we went back and laid waste to it again.
And it was interesting and also tragic that, going with the point you just made, during the run-up and the drum beating for war and going into Iraq, the Bush administration never mentioned those bombings in the so-called no-fly zones. They never mentioned that there was somewhere between 300,000 and 400,000 sorties flown by U.S. and British warplanes, and that during those years, not one single manned aircraft was ever shot down by the Iraqis, and that in fact was more of a measure of Iraqi military capability than the so-called, supposed WMDs.
Yeah, the Operation Iraqi Freedom, as it's called, is widely touted as a brilliant military victory. The Iraqis had no air force; they had old weapons. It was a slaughter in the same way that back in 1991, when the Iraqis were fleeing Kuwait, trying to get home, the infamous Turkey shoot, which I discussed in the book as well, which was they were strafed up and down the highway. They were defenseless. I should add another point, which I wanted to mention, and that is one of the reasons that the government has to persuade us that this war this more recent war was justified is that there really are only two reasons for us being in Iraq. The first reason is to establish a permanent military presence in the Middle East. And the second is to have access to the oil in Iraq. As I point out in the book, and many others have pointed out, Sudan has nothing of interest or value to us. If it had oil, we would be there in force, stopping the genocide and probably contributing to some of it as well. So that those are the two reasons we're in Iraq. All of the other subterfuges, freedom, democracy, liberation, and so on, are simply false, and they need a masquerade of rhetoric to cover the real reasons.
Does the book itself, or you as an author, have a website, or where could people get more information about the book?
I don't have a website. I know what would happen if I did, and I don't want to be inundated. But the book is certainly available. It's early now. It just came out, but it's available through its publisher, Common Courage Press, in Maine. Locally, in Portsmouth, the book is going to be available at the River Run Bookstore. I support independent bookstores, so I won't mention the other places it can be obtained, but River Run certainly here, over in Concord at Gibson's. I hope to make it widely available.
Well, we hope so, too. And Thomas Lee, author of Battle Babble, New Hampshire author, I might add, thanks a lot for being with us today.
You're very welcome. I appreciate the opportunity.